Before we start today's show, we want to share some exciting news from the Radiotopia family. Normal Gossip is back for its sixth season. If you've ever found yourself eavesdropping on strangers' juicy conversations and maybe wanting to chime in too, this show is for you. On Normal Gossip, host Kelsey McKinney shares the juiciest gossip sent in by listeners all around the world, then brings in a special guest to weigh in on the actions within the story. The stories are everything from petty to bizarre to downright strange. Fun fact, you might recognize a few of this season's guests from the Radiotopia universe. So check it out. New episodes start April 17th. Listen to Normal Gossip wherever you get your podcasts. This episode of Radio Diaries is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Radiotopia.
From PRX's Radiotopia, this is Radio Diaries. I'm Joe Richman.
How would you describe your work?
I'm a processing clerk.
I'm a carpenter from South Carolina.
Boring, monotonous.
Your mouth gets tired of talking.
Oh, I love it. There's never a day long enough.
I mean, you got a wife. Nothing wrong with it. People have known it for years.
If you've been listening to our podcast recently, then you know that we're in the middle of a mini-series celebrating our hero Studs Terkel and his book Working. Here's a quick recap. In the early 1970s, Studs went around the country with a reel-to-reel tape recorder, interviewing people about their jobs. Studs talked to people from all walks of life, from steelworkers to paperboys to press agents, and he turned those interviews into the book Working. It became a surprise bestseller and has gone on to influence a few generations of storytellers, including me. But for 40 years, very few people had ever heard those interviews. After the book was released in 1974, the tapes were packed away in Studs' home office. For the past year, we at Radio Diaries, along with our partner Project AND, have been combing through those recordings. Going through all those tapes from four decades ago, you can hear how different things were back then. Unions were strong. You talked to an actual operator to make a long-distance phone call. And private investigators didn't have something called the internet. But the story that really struck me the most wasn't about how much has changed over the past four decades, but how much hasn't. This is the story of Renault Robinson, a Chicago police officer and one of the founders of the Afro-American Patrolman's League.
I'm talking with Renault Robinson, and I'm thinking, Renault, why did you become a policeman?
Well, policeman is looked upon in the black community as an important thing. Even though people are afraid of them or people have bad thoughts about them, the position itself is still one of importance. I quit a job paying more money to become a police officer. And sometimes I wonder if that was the best decision to make.
Could you describe your day, the day of a policeman in uniform?
Well, first of all, you're given an assignment and a partner. Most of the white guys are wondering what black they're gonna get today. And the black guys are wondering the same thing. Which one of these fools am I gonna get today? A black cop is saying the only reason I'm with this white cop is because they want to protect his life while he's riding around the black community to ward off the bullets. And so, you know, there's hard feelings on both sides.
Well, what happens then during these 8 hours? You're sitting with this white guy.
Say nothing to each other at all. Can you imagine that for 8 hours?
So there's no conversation?
Very little or none. Very little or none.
Got told Studs exactly what the situation was. My name is Renault Robinson, and when I first started on the police department, I went in there to do the best job I could as a policeman. But that became very difficult once I realized what the true circumstances were.
What led to your disenchantment?
I think it was just seeing blacks being treated one way and whites being treated another. You know, the majority of the policemen in my station were white. The opinions that they have of black people are that they're all criminals, they have no morals, no scruples, they're dirty and nasty, et cetera, et cetera.
So the trouble is with an ordinary citizen. Could you dwell on this?
Well, I would say about 60% of police citizen contact start or a traffic situation. Certain units have really developed a science around stopping the automobile. In other words, in their minds, if they stop 100 cars in the black community, the likelihood of them finding one or two or three violations of some sort is highly possible. Now, of course, after you've stopped 1,000, you've got 900 people who are very pissed off. Teachers, lawyers, doctors, or just average working people who haven't broken any law and are very irritated and aggravated about being stopped by the police. And black folks or minority tolerance of that police brutality has grown very short.
Because they won't accept it.
They won't accept that treatment. They won't accept that dehumanizing, degrading treatment. That's why more young kids are being killed by the police than ever before.
50 years later, whether it's Chicago or Baltimore or Detroit, the same thing is happening in all of these cities. It just feels like deja vu. At the time I joined the Chicago Police Department, I was young, and I guess I was very energetic about doing something about racism. You know, I remember they forced us to put sawed-off shotguns, police-issued, in the squad cars, loaded with 00 buckshot. If you're a hunter, you know what that is. I and, you know, a handful of other black police officers just felt that that was wrong. You know, chasing a kid or chasing a stolen car, and you got something that could tear somebody's head off. So the Afro-American Patrolman's League, we raised hell, we picketed, we marched, we did everything to get the police department to take those guns out of the squad cars. Of course, speaking out like that on a regular basis made me a popular fellow in the police department. You go into your locker room and you see in your mailbox is human feces and cigarette ashes and trash. You kind of know what that means. You go in the bathroom and there's a picture of you on the wall dressed as a native with a bone in your nose. You know how they feel. They were all knicky-knack stuff just to try and force me out of the department.
I know the fact that you now have the reputation of speaking out, speaking your mind. Every now and then you're suspended.
I've got a 30-day suspension pending now.
What do they use as grounds?
Well, this latest one, I'm being suspended because I was passing out literature in the police station to black police about the Patrolman's League. I was arrested in the station, and I'm being suspended for conduct unbecoming a policeman.
In the end, I knew I had to go. I mean, I had fractured too many feelings and too many people who didn't want to hear what I had to say. And I left. I get a small pension now, and the beat goes on.
In 1973, 2 years after his interview with Studs Terkel, Renault Robinson and the Afro-American Patrolman's League filed a landmark discrimination suit against the Chicago Police Department. The case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which ruled in favor of the Patrolman's League. Renault Robinson retired from the force in 1983. He still lives in Chicago. Our next story comes from Studs Terkel's interview with a young advertising executive. She's sort of like Peggy Olson from Mad Men.
This is about the work you do. You're a big shot, aren't you?
Yes. Well, I write and produce television commercials. Big ones like General Mills, Campbell, Kraft, and I'm probably one of the, say, 10 highest paid people at the agency.
Do you have a question what you're selling?
Do I ever question what I'm selling? Oh, I would say all the time, of course. I don't think what I do is essential or necessary, even that it performs much of a service. You know, you're saying to a lady, because this oil comes from the bottom of the algae on the sea, you're going to have a timeless face. That's a crock of shit. I mean, I know that. It's a part of my job. I do it.
But something else involved here.
You are the only woman there.
Well, I'm the only female producer at the agency. You know, it used to be the token black. Now I'm definitely the token woman. And I'm ideal because I know how to handle myself, obviously, or I wouldn't be where I am. I'm young enough to communicate, I think, effectively, and yet I'm old enough to see, you know, the danger.
What is the danger? I mean,
well, the danger is aging. I mean, I am in a profession in which I cannot age. I could not be doing this at 38.
You might not be as valuable as you are right now?
Well, I haven't seen many women in any executive capacity age gracefully in the advertising business.
Just for the sake of the record, I might describe you as very, very attractive, you know.
Well, I don't make any attempt to be, you know, the glasses and bun and totally asexual image, because that isn't the way I am. And I'm not overly provocative either. It's this thin line. When I'm with a strange group of men, say new clients, I'm frequently taken for the secretary, you know. Generally, the first reaction I get is they don't look at me. The first three meetings at Johnson, even if I would ask a direct question about the assignment or the project, they would answer the question and look at my boss or another man in the room. They had trouble relating just around a conference table.
So you're the equal of these guys, because you're bright.
Yes, but I make them very nervous. Some of them can't categorize me. Here I am, this young girl, you know, she's not married. What's the matter with her? Doesn't she want a real life as a woman? You know, there are always labels that people use. Is it a lesbian? Is it, you know, somebody's mistress in the company? Currently, the label that I enjoy, you know, in quotes, is a women's libber, which I'm, you know, I advocate a certain amount.
Now, here we come to a key. You are a young woman executive, creative spirit. You're facing up to double standards, obviously.
All the time. Yeah. There was a time when I thought if I'd been born male, it would have been a lot simpler. But I don't daily think of that. I just sit here and I think, Christ, you know, look where you are.
This is a fantastic interview.
I'll stop the tape.
Studs Terkel interviewed an advertising executive in 1972. She appeared in his book under the pseudonym Barbara Herrick. When I first read Working, one of the things that struck me was the way it elevated the stories of ordinary people and their daily lives. Studs celebrated the uncelebrated. One of the chapters in the book is called Cradle to the Grave. It starts with a baby nurse and ends with a gravedigger.
It's a wintry day. We're seated in a cemetery in the outskirts of Chicago. I'm seated with Homer Martinez. Let me just test this for a minute. Could we start from the very beginning? How long you been a gravedigger?
About 8 years. So I started here about 1959.
A gravedigger, someone who has a shovel and digs out dirt and helps lift the coffin and put it in the grave and covers it with dirt. How do you feel about your work?
I never had a dream to have this kind of job. But I believe it is important, because not anybody can be a gravedigger. I mean, you can be a sewer digger, you know, can dig sewers. But sewers, you just can dig a hole any way they come. You know, you can throw dirt and you just can make a mess of them. But when you dig a grave, this grave have to be neat and clean. All you see is a square hole and they're perfect.
I suppose also the fact that a human body, human being.
Yes, is going in through this grave in there.
This is a question. You're in the middle of a great deal of grief.
Mm-hmm.
Does that affect you in any way?
Well, a funeral is one of the natural things in the world. I mean, it's like any other thing that happened. And you just have to just take it. I mean, you just have to take it. But believe me, sometimes it's real sad, some of these funerals. I never go to a funeral without a sunglasses. Because your eyes is the first thing they show when you have a big emotion on a funeral. And I always use black glasses.
When you are called a gravedigger yourself, do people look at you a certain way? I mean, when you're off work, you're somewhere else at a social gathering.
Well, I usually tell them that I'm a caretaker. That's usually the way they know me. I take care of this place.
Anything else you feel like saying about your work, your feeling about your job?
Well, I enjoy it very much, especially in summer. This is one of the nicest jobs in summer.
It is?
Yes, because we have over 100 acres of grass to be cut in here. When those lawnmowers go through, they smell nothing but fresh cut grass, and it's just fantastic, the aroma of that grass when it's cut.
You live on the grounds?
Yes, I've been living on the grounds for almost 12 years. They offer me the house, and I stay here, and I've been staying, and there I am.
You live on the grounds with your family?
Yes.
A last extra question, Mr. Martinez. Would you like to do this work for the rest of your life?
That's a very good question. I don't really know myself. I believe I'm just going to have to stay here probably until I die. I'm not going to be too bad for me because I've been living 12 years already in the cemetery. So if I die, I'm still going to be living in the cemetery. So that's going to be all right with me.
Homer Martinez, interviewed by Studs Terkel at the Shalom Memorial Park Cemetery. Martinez retired in the 1980s. If you pick up a copy of the book, Martinez's interview appears under the pseudonym Elmer Ruiz. Stay tuned for part 3 of The Working Tapes, coming soon on the Radio Diaries podcast. We'll be bringing you stories of a private eye, a hotel piano player, a jockey, and more.
John Henry said to his captain, "No man ain't nothing but a man."
Our series is produced by me, Joe Richmond, with Nellie Gillis and Sarah Kate Kramer. Our editors are Deborah George and Ben Shapiro. Special thanks to our producing partner, Jane Sachs, and our organization, Project AND. Our radio series is part of the larger Working in America project. You can submit your own story at working.org. Also thanks to the Studs Terkel Radio Archive at WFMT, the Chicago History Museum, and NPR. We couldn't have produced this series without support from the Hitachi Foundation and the National Endowment for Humanities. Radio Diaries is part of Radiotopia from PRX. We have support from MailChimp, the Knight Foundation, and listeners like you. I'm Joe Richmond. Thanks for listening.
Yes, he laid down his hammer, and he died.
Radiotopia.